perception, things like that. And it is all, I think a lot of it is sort of ultimately a belief, you know, in these things, which is not really, I mean, a lot of assumptions that are sort of ignored questions. Mm-hmm. So that was the part that I was saying.
To record?
Sorry?
Is it okay to record?
You? Sure.
Okay. Sure.
So that was the thing that sort of got me at the end to this belief. That was Stanford after my PhD. So there was underneath are sort of things like rhythm and systems theory, which sort of like I thought were still sort of important to sort of take, keep with me. Then I was basically sort of through, kind of embedded in the, at the time, which sort of Xinwei knows, was sort of the beginning of computer sort of philosophy of how does the computer and the intelligent, the human intelligent relate, human interface, which I thought is interesting for a psychologist to get into, in terms of getting into, that was how I started in being interested in design. Mm-hmm. So basically, how do you actually sort of intervene in any such way? So at that point, it was sort of moving from quote-unquote research into what was called action research, namely research that was not necessarily directed at increasing knowledge, but was also trying to make a practical, sort of like have a practical impact. And I basically then sort of through odd bits and pieces went and joined the Institute for Research and Learning, which basically was going into organizations and in trying to understand organizations.
Yes.
That was, it came out of Xerox, Xerox PARC, Xerox Foundation, gave it, it's the first 5 years sort of descending sort of bits of money, and then it was sort of supporting itself by basically selling its services to mostly tech companies at first, and then sort of on. And then it collapsed, it's about 2000, it folded. So that was, so. Okay, so there the idea was basically, so this did a couple of things. Well, first and foremost, I had to learn ethnographic methods. So there were a lot of anthropologists in that group. It was basically Jean Lave, who was, you know, so Xerox PARC had Lucy Suchman and a couple of people. Jean, so she did not join, but a number of people from that group sort of came into the Institute for Research and Learning. And it was a mix, interdisciplinary. There were some linguists, there were some computer scientists, things like that. So it was a whole bunch of people. But the idea was basically, how do we understand organization? Original with the idea, so that computers could become usefully employed there. But that ultimately then became sort of an issue of saying, under the guidance of the anthropologist, how can you see an organization as a social organism? So this goes back now saying the collective entity as a collective thing in which specific things like learning could happen or whatever. So that has sort of emergent properties. And those emergent properties you need to understand in order to basically then, and that was sort of like the change management aspect, in order to intervene and make and create a change. So that's really sort of like the key thing. From then on, basically, that was the kind of work that I've done, which was retroactively, I found out there were sort of like psychologists like Kurt Lewin that were sort of in that area that basically created, had talked about an iterative process, very much how designers now talk. And I basically then sort of went into organizations to sort of try and, try to sort of leverage their own resources and their own understanding in a reflective move to change themselves. So that I was sort of a, not the master and not the one who learns everything, but I was more like a process guide who helped them, so to speak, put together what they understood, teach them a little bit about a method that of reflective ethnography, blah, 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 and basically then allow them to generate something that was sort of tailored to their own organizational being that would make sense, and that we then try to implement. So this was sort of like, so I was a consultant for many years.
What were they calling that research method at that time?
It had a couple of names. One was rapid prototyping, you know, that was still the idea of design. Then we called it, when I had the own my own company with an anthropologist, and we called it water cooler logic, because the key thing was about leveraging the social relationships, so both formal and informal. So the key was basically, I was saying, the social capital that sort of resides in an organization, the, you know, who you like, with whom you can get along. This was basically, we were, so to speak, our work was, so to speak, like riding on those connections. So this was, again, networks. So it was like back with the brain. It was networks of people, networks of things. So then also, of course, the different practices. That was also the anthropology, whatever, that we investigated to basically understand how they, and then systems theory to some extent as an overriding thing, right, because you're trying to understand how the pieces functionally fit together, because of course the organization would only pay you if you could at least promise that you would do something that would help them. So that's sort of where I am. And when Chinwe says we want people who are master of something, I'll say, that won't get me in, because I could not claim mastery of any of these things. I'm with everything sort of after whatever, having done this for over 10 years, I find I'm sort of getting better and better at sort of like, sort of leading people from behind to basically get them into situations where they begin to reflect on where they are and begin to generate things and begin, so, but, you know, mastery, far from a mastery, so, but it's always fascinating. So I always come out of every one of those projects saying, okay, I understand something better. I could have anticipated certain things which I didn't anticipate, you know, because it's a, we're in the issue of similarity, so a la Wittgenstein, so a family resemblance. There is always certain things it has and certain things that it doesn't have. And you never know which ones and which combination shows up. But it's still, for me, sort of fascinating. Long time ago, I had sort of like, I don't know, I had this dream that, like René Thom, I would do this for organizations, that you have, so to speak, the qualitative, the phenomenology of organizations. Well, forget that one, okay. But so to speak, phenomenology is sort of like my philosophical background, certainly. Phenomenology is one of my things that I am sort of care about. And I think, you know,
actually, I will say something about mastery. I mean, I don't want to say this because he's my spouse, but I mean, it's good to pledge your house, as they say in Greece, otherwise it collapses on you. I think Helga is a master in the sense that right now, if she wanted to, and she has been offered the chance, but she turned it down, to be a chief consultant in places like McKinsey. So McKinsey Consulting is a certain kind of, you know, now to use the fancy name, you know, they go in, they have, they're quite sophisticated,
yeah.
And they go around both intervening and writing papers and doing all kinds of stuff that gets them very nice fees, and
yeah.
At the same time they do.
Was that true? McKinsey's asked you to consult with them?
Yes.
That was a month, yeah, but that's
what?
Some time ago.
That was
some
time ago,
ago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's neat.
Yeah.
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 So I just want to say McKinsey.
That was when we were working with IDEO, and IDEO is one of the, so not the founder, not Kelly, but his brother is a McKinsey or ex-McKinsey. And so
yes.
At that point,
yeah, so
you're
connected with IDEO, which is
like,
a big design
yeah.
firm, you know. It's a
with Gensler.
Gensler.
Yeah, so we did a lot of projects.
Yes.
I mean, with you know, tech companies. So there's like
Sun,
this was sort
Gensler.
Of like Sun, HP,
yeah.
you know, Xerox,
right.
and things like that.
Right.
Then we did a lot of in healthcare. All of the VA, we basically have something like 70 projects. So it's, you know, intense project in all kinds of places.
And
yes.
Well, what I love about what you're telling me right
mm-hmm.
now, and this is like hearing. Hearing the history of design thinking being told to me, but not as a prepackaged method,
right.
but as something that has actually slowly evolved
yeah.
by cobbling together certain things.
And oh, very good. Yeah, yeah. And I have a
cobbling
paper.
Is a word here. No,
I have a
no,
paper
no.
that is I call yeah. composting as a.
Well,
as a
you know, Steve's been talking about screwdriver jury rig.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is jury rig.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The problem is that. As I'm
yeah.
sure you know, the problem with design thinking right now is it comes as a prepackaged deal.
Yeah.
You
yes.
apply it in the situation.
Always,
but
yeah.
you've actually
yeah.
figured out, I mean, you were there from the ground
yeah.
up.
Yeah.
And
I find it a little
yeah.
annoying to go
oh,
back
sure.
to see these people that say, here's a paper, design thinking has not been used up until 2-3 years ago. And I'm saying, of course not.
We were doing it all
yeah,
all
exactly.
Yeah,
of course
yeah,
not.
Right.
But it was called different. It was called action research from the anthropology side.
Yeah.
It was Levine called, I think he also called it,
no,
but anyway, then he called it participatory
design,
and it was called
co-design.
Iterative design, co-design.
Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah,
it was all there, exactly. Yeah.
No,
and I've actually,
story, yeah.
and that is very, I mean, I've basically, one of the papers I was written was basically looking at how this method got together, which was then was called water cooler logic, and you basically said composting as a way of innovating, that it basically was breaking down and rebuilding, but it was not generated from new. So in that sense, ontogenetic processes was sort of not that it's built from scratch, but it is really, the method is more that you sort of let it compost into its constituent smaller parts, and then somebody can come and can rebuild from that something different that has a different frame, a different paradigm, whatever. And I think at that point I was also thinking that Bay Area for a long time was so rich in innovation because there was so much to be broken down, you know, and it was sort of in the memory of the region, to actually in the memory of the people, in the memory of the region, in the memory of the organizations, and all of the different organizations, including, of course, the law, the legal, and so, you know, so all of
them. Kim and Bennett, who's at ASU, you know, Bennett.
Right.
And he and I went through the Bay Area about the same time, I guess, I'm assuming.
And what
you see from, and we were together up until dot-com era, okay, until dot-com bust, I should say. But what was interesting, right around dot-com bust, around 2001, 2002, I could see, and one could see, a double layer of diffusion of composting happening. One is a level of actual source code. So the large files IP held by Next, for example, and by Intelligy, which is IBM and I'm saying this for recording so that Gaiman can pick it up and talk about it. Okay? So be quick. The point is that this is fascinating because we knew the the actual code basis there. Huge amounts of labor went into those things, huge amounts.
And it's true.
They were broken out. It's interesting how they were licensed out. You see them reappearing later on back in Apple.
Bits and pieces.
Why? Because they followed people. They followed. Plus, Netscape, right? The web browser.
Right. Mm-hmm.
The code for all that kind of stuff went into the company from Mozilla to Netscape.
Right.
And the people, the engineers were rehired because part of the engineers had to follow the pieces of IP through software libraries with it's very interesting.
Right.
Yeah.
Which makes total common sense.
Makes absolute sense, And there were the stories that they basically said there was like an engineer who got fired on Friday, on Monday he was back in another job, you know. So there was also this idea of the grapevine, that all of these things, people were connected, and they basically were just, so.
It was very dynamic, very
very dynamic, fast-moving. And it didn't sort of rise into a formality of hiring and whatever.
Wasn't the line something like, you could change jobs without changing your carpool?
Yeah, exactly.
How it comes back to law, however, is the problem that the law at that point was used to maintain IP walls.
Yeah.
So that the engineer could not take a single line of code without getting sued to pieces.
Yeah.
So that's what kept, for example, a lot of interesting IP locked up in my interval research. Well, interval research was funded for $100 million by Paul Allen.
Right.
And finally got closed.
Yeah.
All the IP is locked, even in the art.
Yeah.
Locked up.
Yeah,
so some people I knew who are interval research tried for a year to say, hey, it's only art, so let it out the door. And they were forbidden to do so because even that was considered
because
IP.
So
it's sitting there.
And
what happened to it? Why did it close?
He got tired of funding it.
He was the individual sponsor for it.
Happened.
Right.
Yeah.
So he wrote two checks.
Is that because not much came out of interval?
No, actually, he wrote two checks. He wrote two checks.
He wrote
one check at the beginning, which funded for about 10 years. When I went in there, it was already into the second round funding from Paul Allen, and he had another 2 or 3 years. But what he wanted from everybody inside interval was, the idea was that every, I don't know if you know people there, but every PI was supposed to generate not just a patent or something or papers, that's not enough. It's to generate a whole industry worth $100 million or more. That was the explicit criteria.
Yeah, yeah. So
right?
This was
plus,
sort of like,
plus to do it without talking to anybody.
Sounds like an issue.
To not talk to anybody outside.
Wait, this is
big problem.
That is an interesting paradox.
It escapes me too.
I know where it was.
But he made it all back because he has all the patents.
He made his money back.
All back.
Of course,
so
this 100x100 that didn't.
Did that this time X.
And of course, and it actually is interesting because, as a case, also, these were all superstars that were hired and they then put their team together. And the reality was, yes, something happened. But I would have given a lot to actually sort of be sort
a
of
lot of
that,
things
that,
happened because yeah, I was inside the IP world.
Things,
I was
yeah.
I was junior, but inside the IP world, and a lot of really cool things happened, including things like you know there were real quantum computing people, not like fake quantum computing people, like in Starlab, where I was always also posted just before. So there was real stuff like that, ranging to also things like ESP. But the thing is, and also real machine learning stuff, very deep machine learning stuff, I mean, really amazing stuff. But it all got locked up. So, you know, 15 years later, it's still better than a lot of research you see out there, but it's locked up.
Whatever happened to Liddell?
Is it L-I-T-T-E-L or L-I-T-D-L?
I think it's L-I-D-D-E-L.
E-L-L, yeah.
Oh, well.
Double L, yeah.
Anyway,
not that this matters
a lot.
Well, whatever, we'll come back.
Anyway.
One other thing I want to say before we say Helga, because then you can end. And yes, I mean, one of her techniques, you know, is has to do with the, I think you know how to be in an organizational context and understand it as a process, apropos process group. And I think you should say something more about that, because the idea of process is part of your methodology and your conceptual thing. Okay, so.
Do you find him?
David
Liddell. Yeah, that makes sense. And I have heard the name recently, but I can't remember.
So what happened to Liddell?
Anyway.
Apparently he's on the board of directors for SRI.
SRI is also one thing where you could go in and you basically were saying, okay, whatever your salary is, you have bringing times 10. So these are things, and as far as I know, I just told to people at SRI. They're getting anyway. My process. I don't know, Nicholas, what exactly you want from me, but
Say something about your understanding of design as a process and when you.
Well, I would rather say my idea of an organization is more like a field. So from the network to a kind of a field to a very complex and very inhomogeneous, heterogeneous field. So we were studying organizations in terms of. Communities, community of practice was one of the terms that came out of the Institute for Research and Learning. And that is one thing that I sort of believe that got me interested or whatever, I was interested in teams, so to speak, a new formation that, so to speak, is higher than the individual, but below the organization or the department, not in the formal order, but so to speak, emergent out of some time binding, which has to do with a process, a project, or something like that. So that basically the ontology, let's say, of an organization basically has to take these things into account. That's also what makes me interested in what about collective entities, different from aggregates, so different from this thing when they say wisdom of the crowd, which I don't think is a crowd at all, right? I mean, the aggregate opinion that basically has this beautiful bell-shaped curve that basically gives you a good solution is not the same thing as the crowd that, for example, what's his name, describes when he talks about the fire, the panic, the football stadium, that's the crowd. So they are linked. So this is networks things. These are collective beings that at least for a short time exist and are an entity and things like that. So so on the sort of the level of small groups all the way up to, you know, so this is social psychology, but it's social psychology that we know nothing about. So social psychology has gone to the point of studying dyads, okay? We don't know teams. The CSCW, the computer support, the collaborative work, is struggling for 20 years with the idea of a team. What makes a team collaborate? We don't know what that does, you know, how that works. We're now, as I'm working with this group about sort of like in terms of it's a little, what we call the geezer startup, because everybody who's part of the startup sort of 50 plus. Anyway, so we're also struggling with this idea of what kind of team produces this multiplier effect that is also that this group sort of basically says, you know, there is at one point you're putting together great individuals, but as the team, there is still something yet to happen, that you can have these fusion or whatever that is, which can both turn out to be, so to speak, take it in a specific direction that is independent of what anybody's expertise is in. Mm-hmm. And it can turn out to basically, this is the thing that we're, so to speak, also hoping, right, that there is this thing of an emergence, let's say, even though I don't like the word emergence, but yeah, anyway, that there's something coming out of that that sort of goes beyond what any individual does. So these are the kind of phenomena that I am interested in. And going into an organization, I basically try to treat the organization as if it was this kind of field where I am sort of assembling a group of people that is, so to speak, sort of the smallest possible minimum set that would sort of change a little bit the charge in the field. Yeah.
So what's really interesting is that, sorry, if I...
When
you're talking about, I'm just thinking about multipliers and how designers... Mm-hmm. are starting to think, and this has to do with sort of questions of infrastructure.
Right.
Right.
Of
course. When you're designing infrastructure, it can't be about you're designing a thing, a static thing.
Absolutely.
It has to be that you're designing
a catalyst that
allows for multipliers.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so, I don't know, maybe can you say a little bit more about multipliers?
To some extent, the multiplier is basically just carried over from all of these things, like the startup that basically said the multiplier, you have to bring back so much. So the only thing is basically that you're saying the whole is, so to speak, larger than the sum of the parts, by what factor, right?
Yeah.
So we're basically saying if I get sort of two people together, you know, that are each one, so to speak, an expert in their field, but together they create something that neither had, then it is already a kind of indie multiplication. So that's already simply meant. The other thing with the multiplier, I don't know if that sort of belongs, but it belongs to what you were saying, that certain things you cannot produce, you can only sort of support them, you can basically try to create, so to speak, a culture that is a lot of the anthropological term of culture and atmosphere, infrastructures is just one part of it that basically enables these people to sort of engage in an informal exchange. And so if you block access, you know, if you say you are not allowed to talk to any, so the way in which innovation happens is an enormous amount of sort of cross-fertilization. And if you block that flow, then you're actually doing something to the possibility of innovation, for example, right? So this is one of the things. Yeah. So Apple also puts the same thing out, that they are outsourcing to people because they are also, large organizations find themselves impossible to innovate. So the only way in which they innovate is basically they have to give it off to another group, to a small, you know, create something or outsource it. And then they are, again, through the restriction on communication, reducing the... I mean, so anyway.
Yeah.
So I'm just blah, 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 blah.
It's
blah,
also cannibalization. It's like Bergson talks about cannibalization,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
So, and it's high-up managers are consciously doing this,
right?
So they sometimes they block communication in order to funnel more energy in a certain direction they want to see happen without having to determine everything.
Sure,
they need.
What do you think... and I was thinking about some of what Gannon was talking about. How is all this in this mid-level you were talking about and the dynamics of this mid-level and the creativity that wants to be, how is this related, do you think, to the subcultures and how subcultures do their thing?
Right.
Because Gannon talked about this a little bit, I thought was really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you're talking about the Bay Area, what happened in the Bay Area specifically.
Right.
So there were already people around with a certain kind of past, with certain kinds of completely non-economic and in many cases non-technical interests, who created a kind of environment that carried over in interesting and sometimes important ways, he was talking about, to how the people working on, you know, synthetic biology and bioengineering really viewed, you know, despite all the bullshit, quote unquote, kind of related to what they were doing. So, I think there's a lot to learn from looking at how subcultures work. Because that mid-level sounds to me a lot like, kind of like a subculture.
And it is to some extent, but I think one of the key things is it's basically being there is the most important part, being connected. So there are lots of people there that aren't expert in anything, and they are basically just brought in because they're really connected to somebody else. So there are all of these network studies we're looking at that basically says, okay, what they, I mean, this is sort of like some calling somebody a bridge or something like that. You're saying you have two groups that are really very well connected, but you need somebody who connects the two groups. And there is a person who may not be any expert in anything, but all he does is becomes a link between these two very, very densely connected networks.
Right.
And that is how things sometimes happen. So very often what we're doing or what I'm doing when I'm going into an organization and I'm putting a team together, I'm basically looking at, to initially as a kind of a systems things, what are all the areas that are relevant to the issue we're supposed to addressing? And then I go a little beyond that and more into the peripheral areas. I try to bring these people together, and sometimes already there happens a part of that process that sort of connections are being made that didn't exist before, just in through these first things. So there is a way in which these things are, so to speak, happen in not prior designable, standardizable, identifiable ways. And very often it is basically just the ability of being there that sort of creates a position and a role for somebody who didn't know. And you know, it's also this thing, if we're, at least a psychologist, I'm going away from this idea of the personality trait that is, so to speak, hardwired. And it's basically we find out that people take on different roles and become different persons in different groups, in different contexts. Mm-hmm. And that, I think everybody has that experience. Mm-hmm. But if that sort of becomes a manner of designing groups, then that means, so this is radically opening up the whatever the space for some weird elements to be thrown in. One of the things we're also interested in, I mean, is now has become the idea of disruption. That you need to have a little bit of a weird influence or of a counteracting force that, so to speak, tests at whatever. You know, if you have too much of it, you destroy the team. Mm. If you have none of it, you have this thing of the group thing that everybody sort of collapses into, yes, we love each other, we agree, you know. And so this is all, it's all, so to speak, all in the... It is, none of it is knowledge, okay? All of that is, so to speak, you know, suggestive. That's why I said I'm not master of this. All of these things is kind of things that over the years, I just have seen a lot of different things.
How independent, this is about your formal cause laws, how independent do you think these processes are of content? I mean, just in your experience, that's not just
they're not
just
independent
in your
of content. They're not independent of content, but they're not as dependent on content as we often make it.
As people think.
Love to, because the content is something we can hang on to.
Yeah. So that's why I'm asking this kind of subculture question is
the
gravity of the content is a huge driver
of these
things that people don't know they're doing in a way.
Dark matter.
Dark matter.
No, entanglement, absolutely. I mean, that is a very important force.
Yeah.
We have not gotten a hold of the importance of that thing, of the social relationships, and that the sense of is like the gift economy or whatever we're saying, but there is also theologians, or at least one that I like, talks about the economy of grace, which is basically that you're giving something just because, you know, you're not expecting an accounting. But all of these things are basically things of obligations, of giving and things like that. That produces, that is the entanglement, at least on the human level, that I think creates networks very tensely structured and oddly structured things.
Mm-hmm.
And then sometimes you get the communities that are built on because they're smoking outside, you know, odd stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a link. So we cannot know what content or what context will become now instrumental for bringing sort of a crucial connection about.
Let me ask you about tacit versus explicit.
Sorry,
What time are we supposed to be at your house?
6:00.
Okay,
I'm for six.
Okay.
Just
wine
and beer. It's fine.
Wine or
beer.
I texted my address to you.
Yes.
Have it.
Yes.
Okay.
All right, bye guys.
Thank you so much.
Let me ask you about tacit versus explicit, which is related
to
what I was asking about.
Yeah.
Okay, yes, of course. the thing is that, you know, a positivist will say, well, I only can do my analysis based on what I can see and touch and what people record and give to me. The props, the bodies, what they say, the spatial arrangement. Okay.
Yeah,
now,
yeah.
You
yeah.
study that too. But of course, what you're talking about is pointing to, in terms of field, to that which is tested. Well, that which was seen tested.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
Now, of course, there are ways that these emerge into the explicit through the motions of the bodies,
mm-hmm.
through things that people say and props that get moved around, like, you
mm-hmm.
know, supplies and office desks and things like that. Reassignments of people, right, from group to group. Okay, so you do have data to work with. My question
sure.
to you is, over all these years, you know, you must have, do you have some sense of what to look at first? And then the second question is the knobs, you know, what adjustments,
what
you
do,
that, not just
you,
but what do these people
yeah.
do?
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe, of course, I'm sure there's a lot of tailoring and invention of
mm-hmm.
new props or new explicit things.
Not
I don't
so
know.
Much.
Well, that's what I'm asking.
That's
the
interesting
things that people
thing.
Can do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is the interesting thing is, well, lots of sort of like organizations, basically, their history is also a crucial thing, element in the culture that they create. So there are, so what I would do is, so history, for example, is one element that I would, if you're saying, look, what am I looking at? So these are the kind of things that you can go after. And history sometimes takes the, very often, at least in organizations, takes the form of certain stories, cases, that they say that are instrumental.
Oh, yeah.
They are saying, oh, okay, that was the time before XXX event happened.
This is huge in universities,
yeah,
of course.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Sure.
That's when we introduced such and such, and from now on, nobody can do blah, or whatever, yeah. Or everybody, we have now got some. So that's a lot of the history comes like that. Then you can basically, I'm now talking sort of more explicit stuff. You can look at, so to speak, the values that, so to speak, the organization puts out as what is their, what they
espoused.
Want to have, their espoused stated values. So if you can report on, you can look at that, you know, and that is, so to speak, also something where immediately when you look to talk to people, you would get, so to speak, the gap opening up. They was like, oh, they are saying we're supposed to be, however, this is bullshit, nobody actually cares a damn about that, and so on and so forth, you know. So these are the things that you sort of, but this is more like I used the idea, the term scaffolding.
Mm.
So there are certain things that are in the representational that are sort of stiff and hard. These are the kind of things, you know, you can find them.
Mm-hmm.
But then you sort of speak, you juxtapose it to the soft, weak stuff that people tell you.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of times that we're going to interview to people. And it is the interesting thing that already, me as an outsider, I sort of speak have a special privilege to coming in there because I am, so to speak, the neutral.
Mm-hmm.
So I go in saying, you know, yes, I'm hired, but I just want to talk to you and I want to hear from you then. And amazingly, as you would seem, people actually open up, okay? So I have never, ever, I think one person who did not, in all of the people I've interviewed, I've never had somebody say, I don't want to talk to you, you'll be bought by the leadership, and why the heck would I, you know, want to give you something that you can use against me? So never, ever. So there is a way in which just the fact that you're listening to people talk about themselves, their work, the complexities of their work is rewarding for them. So that is something that I can get.
But
and very seldom is that stuff that is, so to speak, really politically radical or poisonous.
Mm-hmm.
Very often it is just that way.
Mm-hmm.
So
but,
I'm sorry, I'm getting away.
No, just right, but there's an ethics to this.
Yeah, so then there are things of observation. Observations mm-hmm. basically are important because you can basically use strategies that go away from the individual. So often what we're doing is like saying, we're following an object. Let's say you're in an insurance company and you're basically following a form. Somebody fills out a form, a complaint form, and you say, where does it go? Who touches it? You know, how long does it take? You know, when does it end up? Who does something? All right, so that's a way, okay?
Tracer particle.
So exactly,
yeah, yeah,
so
yeah.
It's like tracer substance.
Yeah.
So you're going through and you're basically
nice.
Saying, sometimes you know, we're basically also saying we are becoming the mock person, right? So
mm-hmm.
we did the project with the network, you know, in whatever, it was like 8 hospitals, about communication between patient and provider. And we basically were saying, oh, well, you know, that is the formal versus tacit. Formally, our process looks like that. We get a call, in 50 minutes or less, it'll be answered, it'll be rewarded, and we'll respond. And within 7 days, we have to closure on the such. And then you say, okay, I become a patient, So these are all the ways in which you say the process, that is, so to speak, the scaffold, right? And then the actual practice. And compared, you know, so you're going on to that, and then you say, okay, what really happens, right? Mm-hmm. Exactly. And this is always my joke. I was like, your call is important to me. It's just, this is for me the shortest, like after 2 hours in the loop, right? Exactly. And so on. So these are different strategies of how to go at that. And so I used to use this term of tacit knowledge, but I've sort of given that up because it is not knowledge necessarily. I mean, it is, some of it is known, some of it is well understood. There are the things that everybody knows, but nobody can say, because it's understood that you just don't. So like, there is an ethical kind of thing that when you suddenly somebody speaks about the elephant in the room or whatever, and everybody says, oh yeah, we knew that, you know, kind of, I didn't know that that was the rule that we talk about that. We thought everybody understands. So there is that. Then there are the other things that sort of speak, the partial, the regional knowledge that somebody in the department X can tell somebody of the department Y, and they can basically do the social object or the transitional object. They can say, you are giving us this, but this is really useless because we've already had a change in process and we now have to redo the work you're doing in order to make it fit our input criteria, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So these are the things that then instantaneously, so to speak, can be fixed. But anyway, it is layers upon layers. That's why I'm also saying, when I say it's a very heterogeneous thing, it has all of these things, and all of them are, so to speak, real in a way. So the tacit or the informal is as real as the formal. The formal has real effects. Mm-hmm. The scaffolding, also these kind of stuff, people cannot ignore and do not ignore that, you know, as you know, at the university, there is the same stuff is happening. Yeah.
In terms of building trust, there's an ethic to this. People will probably talk to you, okay, let me just ask. You described to us an ethics about how to do this kind of design, this kind of deep ethnography, participant, where the participants themselves come up with tailoring to others. Okay, so how do these people know that that's your approach? Because if they know this at the outset, then they know to trust you. You know, mm-hmm. It's up to them to come up with solutions, it's up to them to decide to implement or not, mm-hmm. which creates a great deal of power to these people so that they should have no fear of talking to you.
And they don't. They don't, as a rule. But in terms of understanding what it's about, some people do and some people don't. So it's interesting because the last thing I did, which was Long Beach, there was one psychologist there, a very sweet guy, who basically 3/4 through the process basically said, you know what? I was listening to you and I'm saying, what the heck do you want from me? You know, I don't understand this thing at all. It's just now I'm getting it. But that was like, you know, and he was very smart, you know, but he was, to some extent, as the psychologist, he was sort of trying to rationally nail it down. And I was sort of saying, you know, we don't know, you know, we're starting out with something that leadership says we want to have done. Amongst the 7 or 10 of us, we may find out that that's not the right goal, that we're going actually for something else. Then we have to specify if we're going for something else, who are the things we need to understand in order to basically generate a solution. So I'm talking in that way, which to me actually solution is also not, but anyway, you know. So, so and then gradually, so to speak, these things come. Very often what, so to speak, is completely rewarding for them is they go out, talk to people. You know, what they learn is kind of a making contacts. And, you know, so it is the process itself for them is exactly this kind of, it's playing hooky in a way, but it is in a way playing hooky with very good rationale. The fact that they are working together as a team, that they are ideally developed also that kind of sort of trust amongst each other, that we're changing the social capital structure, that there is also, in, you know, relationships are being built as we are uncovering relationships, and so on and so forth. So I can endlessly talk about how this is, so to speak, changing, so to speak, the field from within and how, so to speak, at the end effect, so to speak, the process itself brings about, the solution is only a part, the process that has developed mm-hmm. all of these sort of internal entanglements mm-hmm. is as much part of the solution as, so to speak, an object, the product at the end. So that's
kind of... Let me ask this chair. Carrie's been a chair as well in the department.
I feel your pain. That's
okay, yeah. Okay.
Clinton used to say.
I'm vital interest in
yes.
this kind of question. Because in a sense, if chairs come from the faculty, if they themselves come from faculty, they're not plugged in from outside, then there's a sympathy, hopefully, to...
And
the
that's
practices
the,
of the faculty,
right?
Right. But also the line managers or low, their bottom level of the management structure.
Yeah.
So somebody from on high sets, let's say, a large goal, transformation
right.
of, let's say, getting more interdisciplinary research to happen, whatever that is. Then when you worked in the VA, for example, there are so many layers of hierarchy, right? Or somebody
mm-hmm.
hires you to come in,
mm-hmm.
probably at a very high level, to come in and work with line managers
mm-hmm.
and the worker bees,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, suppose in this process the worker bees and line managers come up with other goals.
Mm-hmm.
Now, those if there are sub goals of the big goal,
right,
then we're okay.
That's fine. Yeah.
But the sub goals go up, point to a big goal, which is actually contradiction.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have an opportunity to go back to your sponsor?
Yeah. Yeah. To actually sort of refocus this thing. Yes. And that's actually it's contradiction. I think is rarely the case.
Yeah.
But certainly deviation from the original goal
mm-hmm.
or a specification, or basically like saying
yeah.
that's not really it.
Yeah.
So it's like one of the things is the VA in Palo Alto where we basically said we don't have enough beds. So this is the Veterans Hospital up there by Park, you know that? Yeah. So basically we were charged to basically come up with a way to basically saying what's wrong, okay? We do not, so how do we fix that? And basically the reality was then, I mean, that won't mean anything to you. The reality is that we have to look at the patient discharge process,
mm-hmm.
which basically means it was not that there were not enough beds. I can explain more, but anyway. So it was really the process whereby patients were let go
mm-hmm.
that was completely, blocked because of the way. So, and then what we did was basically we sort of investigated that, and then we basically found we'd have to sort of, it was like a set of dominoes. We had to talk with the chief of staff to actually change the rounding practices in the medical, in the clinic, so that the time, so that they would do it in the morning rather than the afternoon. So then, so the next step would be that the physician could write a discharge order, and at this discharge order specify the medication the patient needs to go at home.
Mm-hmm.
Then he goes to the pharmacy. The pharmacy has to put together the whole package,
mm-hmm.
and they have to go to the patient to teach him how to use this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then has to be when the patient, then the social worker has to set up a process whereby this patient gets picked up or has transportation and he has a place to land.
Mm-hmm.
And then he can leave the bed and then somebody has to come in and clean the bed
mm-hmm.
before the bed is free.
Mm-hmm.
So that whole sort of many step things that would sort of serve was a process that sort of like, you know, took
mm-hmm.
in a large part of the hospital
mm-hmm.
had to be lined up in time so that
mm-hmm.
because the cleaning staff left at 2 p.m. so that whole thing was done so they could still clean the bed and the bed wouldn't basically be, so
mm-hmm.
to speak, being empty.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if that's a good example,
yeah.
but anyway,
yeah.
so this is what it sometimes takes, you know.
That makes sense. I would think, you know, that if somebody hires you to do this, they would want you to come back and say, hey, you know what, you guys thought this was the problem. But that's actually not the problem.
Yeah.
The problem
yeah.
is over here.
Yeah.
I would want
yeah.
to be told
yeah.
that if
yeah.
I'm paying you money.
And actually,
to fix
I have
it.
Never
I mean,
had a real sort of like somebody saying, no way, you're going to do what you're told.
Yeah,
because
right.
these people actually know that they are far removed from
yeah.
the reality
exactly.
down there.
They know what they don't know.
They
exactly.
know what they don't know that.
Okay.
And they are
mm-hmm.
happy if somebody
yeah.
says, well,
yeah.
you know, you said that, but here really this is what's mm-hmm. happening. So
yeah.
we need to change what we're going for.
Right.
And that was accepted. And also, as we started, when we developed this method, we first wanted to have sort of middle managers in the process. Because we're saying that helps, you get authority, these people know. And we realized that it wasn't working. We had then our team, that was sort of the management team. We have put together our team from the people at the floor, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
That,
mm-hmm.
you know, they were really, so in the VA, the people are working with patients that are out there, that are very often the lowliest of the low, they are paid
mm-hmm.
at $12,
mm-hmm.
you know, they have very little education,
mm-hmm.
but have an enormous knowledge. I mean, have an enormous knowledge
mm-hmm.
and enormous guts. Because as I was also saying, that the VA, and we were saying, as I'm talking about it, the VA, which is a political machinery, historically, they have, with every new secretary, they are putting in new legislation about something or other. And everybody in there is supposed to follow all the legislation, which is totally impossible. Nobody can. There is not enough time or money in the world to actually do that. So the physicians have 20 appointments, and they are supposed to take up sort of to the whole
20-minute appointments?
For the first, then 20. 40 minutes if you're a new patient, 20 minutes if you're a returning patient. At that point, you're basically supposed to be explaining your story, you're getting the whatever they takes, any good, that's, you know. And at the end, you're supposed to be treated to a talk about how to stop smoking, how to integrate your medications to make sure that they are, you know, not contraindicated to these kind of things. You know, it's completely impossible. And the clerks out front are supposed to make decisions about eligibility for what kind of service and what kind of treatment. They can't possibly know. So
right.
It's the whole thing is like gray. It's
right.
fog. These people doing a fantastic job
right.
paddling through fog and basically making decisions, you know,
right.
sometimes because lots of them come out of veteran families or have been related
yeah.
and feeling very emotionally very connected
right.
and making, so to speak, doing sort of to
yep.
the best of their kind of things
yep.
to help the people as much as they can.
So we see also
so
that
it's,
so for instance,
yes,
this
yeah, yeah,
propagation
sorry.
Of knowledge to
yes.
the fringes. It's propagation of medical knowledge to the fringes, to the front desk people who say, well, actually, you should do this. And they do this undercover because they're not legally
yeah.
allowed
Absolutely.
To do that.
Exactly.
So I see this happening
yeah.
in Montreal, I see
yeah.
this happening in
yeah.
the Bay Area, where because there's no other way for the patient to get, the doctors
mm-hmm.
go through a formal set of actions
exactly.
to do.
Right.
Issue these tests, ask some questions, issue these tests, and that's it. And sign it within 20 minutes and sign
right.
it out because they have
right.
a throughput issue, the
mm-hmm.
throughput quota.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that means that what they really want to know is to do, they ask the receptionist.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
this happens. And they keep saying, no, I actually can't tell you officially what, but this is what I think you should do.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So,
no, and it's
so
exactly every time with the project,
uh-huh.
you know,
yeah.
the people that were part of the team, they
yeah.
became the expert. They
yeah.
became the go-to people
yeah.
afterwards.
Yeah.
And it was exactly, so they basically, and also it was one of the directors of one of the networks and things that basically, he acquired ethnographic techniques. So the next time I was there, I saw him sitting there with his notebook, with the patient advocate, and doing an interview, and I thought that's sweet, you know. So it was nice, but it was really that he also many people were saying, including the guy in Palo Alto, the chief of staff. He says, "Now I know. I'm just going to that guy. I am not going to the manager. I'm going to the front line. This guy knows exactly what is happening." So it's, you know, so in terms of knowledge, that is really, I mean,
mm-hmm.
it reevaluates that what they know, and they know an enormous amount, you know, enormous.
So I think the way it's relevant to this, what is it called?
Fantastic.
Autogenetic Processes Group, OPG,
mm-hmm.
is because if we really want to have a world-facing aspect to the work that we're doing, I'm thinking of Sid Nagel, who's a physicist at Chicago University, who has a lab on solid state. And
okay.
your help is reading solid
I'm,
state.
I'm reading solid state theory right now. Yeah, exactly.
Lab.
Yeah.
So
Nagel's yeah,
lab
okay, should see.
Looks
yeah.
at things like water droplets bouncing on hot plates and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And the model for his laboratory is, you know, the Nagel laboratory, where theory comes to die.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm thinking of all Helga's kind
oh,
of experience, and maybe
uh-huh.
people like Helga, is where our theory will, well, not die critically, but, you know, encounter the implacability of the social world.
Mm-hmm.
And I really think
yeah.
that we need more like this to understand.
Yeah,
really.
I mean, it's only good as far as it's good. And then,
yeah,
and then
yeah.
it stops, you know, then you need something else.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
now I was thinking about you, some of the stuff you were talking about. I mean, I had exactly this experience being a department chair. We had, you'll appreciate this, you know, there's this, the only growth industry practically in academia now is that upper to mid-upper administration.
Yeah.
So we
and
used to have
been,
like.
By the way, it has been 40 years.
Yeah,
okay.
I agree.
Yeah.
That's true. We're called associate deans.
Yeah. Well, now that whole process is on steroids now. And for us, it's actually the vice president level.
Okay.
So you know,
yeah,
vice
yeah.
president used to mean something.
Yeah.
And
now
we just have yeah we just have this proliferation of vice presidents.
Yeah, like Wells Fargo.
Yeah.
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 Exactly.
Yeah.
And I think it has. I think it has to do at least it has a lot to do. The fact that it is at that level with how your particular university is structured,
yeah.
what's the relationship between the president's office and the provost's office, mm-hmm. and so on. So my favorite one, we got this guy a few years ago. I think I told the story to some of these people, but we got this guy who, his PhD was in industrial psychology, and his title is Vice President for Institutional Excellence.
No,
it's like my favorite bullshit academic advice of
it's
all
like
time.
It's a letter to Santa Claus.
And so, but the reason he was the reason he was hired is, you know, we have these accrediting agencies that we have to satisfy, and we had this provost who was an astrophysicist who had, you know, been at Rice forever, had no under his idea of the humanities was I love to go to the opera. Mm-hmm. That was it. and he just ignored the accreditation process for like 10 years or something.
Were put on probation?
And we were put on probation. And his attitude to being put on probation was, fuck it, we don't need to satisfy these people. What are they going to do to us? So, but the president got wind of it. And so he's like, we got to hire somebody to clean up this mess. So what this guy really does, institutional excellence, really means everybody's got to get their accreditation paperwork in order.
I know, and he has to put together and get the report out.
That's right.
Because I've
That's
been
right.
in Long Beach had the same problem.
That's right. Exactly. So it's a typical problem. So I went to see this guy, and as I'm walking to his office, I'm going like, oh, this is just like, oh my God, seriously, you know, like, am I doing this? You know, and so I had a whole series of meetings with him. And
as chair?
Yeah, I was department chair at the time, and because he's meeting with each chair. And so, you know, I go meet with him, and I basically say, why do I have to do this? And he said, well, the answer is really simple. He said, if we don't satisfy the regional accrediting agency, then we have to deal with the federal government, because we get money from them.
And then you don't
And
get
you do not
anymore.
Want to do that, because if you look at their stack of what's required to satisfy them, it's a lot bigger stack than the Southeast Accrediting Agency. So let's keep them happy. They keep the feds off our back. I'm like, oh, okay, that's a good answer. Uh-huh. So I went back to the faculty reporter, then I went back. And he said, actually, I'm starting a pilot program. Mm-hmm. I'm going to pick, you know, maybe three, four departments who want to kind of help me pilot how to keep this thing rolling. And so I said, I'll do it. Uh-huh. And so I went back to my faculty and I tried, and they were like, what? They were like, what kind of, you know, and I said, look, I said, here's the problem. If I could go hide under a rock and make this go away, that's what I would do.
Right.
But it's not going to go away.
No. Yeah.
So what we should do is get in on the ground floor and make this thing plug and play. Because I said, look, all the paper he wants about the undergraduate curriculum, what's the relationship between 100 level, 200 level, how does this lead to something, how does it make sense? Mm-hmm. I said, these are all conversations we have in our faculty and in our committees.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, so let's find out on the front end of the process what paper he wants, so we don't have to do everything twice.
Absolutely. That's
you know,
it.
And
that's
so I said, that's why I volunteered for the pilot program.
Yeah. No, that's
you know, and now, and it's just a rolling, and I'm glad I did, because he had some crazy ideas. He was like, I was like, well, what are we going to review? Like, you know, three courses. He's like, actually, you're going to review every course that you have on like a rolling basis. And I said, John, you're fucking out of your mind. That's not going to happen. And he was kind of taken aback. But I said, you know, what we can do is we can pick representative courses from the 100 level, 200 level. Yeah. And we can do that.
Right.
And of course, our core requirements, you know, we can do that on a rolling basis. Mm-hmm. And so we've got it down now. It's just kind of a part of the normal committee where it's not that big of a deal.
No,
you know, he's happy, Sachs is happy, you know.
Right.
But it's this kind of process that you're...
It's this kind of process, but of course there's always more of that. Right?
Oh, of course.
The problem with bureaucracy is it always adds and it never goes away.
No, yeah. Right.
Let's just say that I'm older. I'm the oldest person in the room. So I've been an academic since 1969. I have watched associate deans, and now you tell me vice presidents.
And vice presidents.
Proliferate. And I was at Penn, University of Pennsylvania, and here was the deal. After World War II, maybe after Sputnik, but I think it's after World War II, the federal government said to universities, we want to support research at universities. And the universities came back and said, yes, but you know, it's going to cost us an overhead to do the research at our universities. This was so the U.S. could be competitive internationally.
Uh-huh.
It's going to cost us. So So the government made a huge mistake. It could have said, we'll give you 15% overhead, and you do not have to justify it. And if you don't spend 15%, you'll have a slush fund. What it said was, if you could justify your overhead,
we will
pay it to you. But what incentive structure did that create? It's, we have to come up with needs that we have that are always justifiable. Therefore, we sprout associate deeds, each of whose department are doing something that must be useful,
like
the one you're talking about.
Institutional excellence.
Institutional excellence.
So there's this sprawling of of administrative sub-departments, and they're all doing something that's valuable.
Just ask them.
That is exactly this book by Parkinson, who basically proved exactly after a certain size, there is enough work to go around. You don't have to have external input in order to sustain yourself and keep busy.
One of the things we found to look at the following.
The
University of the Future.
Isn't it the case
that these little fiefdoms
create
a need for intermediate fiefdoms that mediate between the fiefdoms?
Of course, because every division of labor produces its own need for coordination.
Right.
So you divide and then you coordinate. And you can, with every point of division, you put in a coordinator. And if it gets larger, you have, that is also first a coordinator, then you have a coordinating department.
And it's
all excellence.
We should change the name to ontogenetic process madness.
OPMG.
This used to piss me off so much.
Yeah.
You're going to agree with what I'm about to say. Look, said I. So just personally, I was in the Department of Biochemistry and Biology in the School of Medicine. I paid some substantial fraction of my own salary. I paid 65% overhead on the salary that I paid myself to the university.
That's what Stanford has too.
I was in that profit center. They were paying me X a year. I was paying 110% of X, either to me or to the university. I didn't cost them anything. Meanwhile, this rule that says, if you can justify it, we'll pay your overhead, sucks money out of actually doing, for example, science.
Yes, absolutely.
Or whatever.
That's the same, Stanford has the same. And I think also 60, 65, exactly.
It's just terrible.
It is terrible. Now, people go and they're basically saying, why should I bring money and then you guys take 60% over half and for nothing? For nothing. I get basically just.
But this is not a new complaint.
No, it's not new.
I was making it 40 years ago.
It's not a new complaint.
There's a law. We've got a law.
Right. We've got
whatever
a law
it
here.
Is, it says, you're fucked as a professor.
Even though it's the aristocracy.
The big change, and you would know exponentially more than me about this, but my impression, just from being in this line of work and talking to people, the big change is the downward pressure. In many cases, it's just about anticipating litigation and auditing, anticipating audits, and various forms of accountability. But the downward pressure of that, proliferates through every single layer, all the way down to the rank and file. And as you said, and then you need people to manage this massive new layer.
So we could come up with a couple of sort of quasi laws. Exactly. That's one. The other one is also, at least I've observed by the VA, there is always this thing, one instance always must produce a general response.
Right.
So one computer that is stolen with patient data, and then all of the VA within a week said everybody has to account for every technology, every program, every device that is connected to the network. And we were talking to people, it was an amazing amount of work, largely totally pointless because it didn't make it more secure. But it was these kind of things like the public gets to see that we're making an effort.
Absolutely.
But it's just pointless. But so that's another one.
Yeah, I just thought of another one.
Okay, good.
It's historical.
Okay.
So I was very lucky I went to Oxford.
Yes.
I can actually do an Oxford accent. I'd be quite good at it. Well, I went to Magdeburg, which was founded in 1540, you see. And roughly since around 1470, whenever the first college came to Oxford, there's dons. And the dons ran their college. Mm-hmm. That was it. For example, when I was there, mm-hmm. the college was run by the junior dean of arts, the senior dean of arts, and the president, and the bursar. Mm-hmm. And they were all dons. Mm-hmm. That was it.
Yeah.
And the university is just a collection of colleges. There is no mm-hmm. Oxford University, yeah. just mm-hmm. all the colleges. Mm-hmm. Well, a few university buildings, so it's not mm-hmm. quite like the like. I can't remember the name of the mm-hmm. main line. Bodleian.
The Bodleian line.
Bodleian,
yeah. So, what's happened is Oxford has grown an enormous administrative structure mm-hmm. in the past 50 years. I was there, I guess, 50 years ago. And it'd be interesting to look at the rate of growth of that administrative structure. And the point of it is, it's worth thinking about this, you guys, is for 400 years they didn't have any.
Yeah, yeah. Right.
The
yeah.
same thing, four dons or five dons ran each college. Mm-hmm. And they did just
everything.
Fine.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
this is why when we were talking yesterday. Yeah.
I mean, for 400 years.
Yeah.
This,
yeah.
this is nothing. So what happened 40 to 50 years ago? Mm-hmm. So that now
right.
Oxford, having decided,
right.
okay, we're going to be a university. I don't know this, but I bet it's utterly filled with cross rippling, ruffling regulation like any other
yeah.
university.
Yeah.
yeah,
sure.
This is after 400 years of not doing it.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's obviously not necessary
uh-huh.
in order to function as a great university
yeah, exactly.
to have this entire behemoth structure mm. now in place and justifying
okay.
itself.
Yeah, I can show pride of pay because Austria started the bureaucracy that is now kind of eating us all up. No, so the Austro-Hungarian, yeah, Dankeschön, yeah.
Austro-Hungarian.
Austro-Hungarian Empire,
yeah.
they started this country, they also had a beautiful spy network and they had censorships and all of the good stuff, you know.
Wow.
But yes, there was the administration. I think we're now, this is exactly the problem. Now that thing is, yeah, it's like a cancer. It grows and grows and it doesn't.
And you got Weber and Kafka along.
Yeah, you got Weber
yeah.
too. Yeah,
yeah, no,
look, I already have a sense of humor.
Yeah.
I don't need this. Believe me, I have a sense of humor.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Sorry, brother.
God.
Yeah.
Okay, so, Niklas. Should we hear something of the physics?
Well, can we
take a couple
of minutes? Yeah, I'm just saying because.
Just saying.
Thank you. Well, thank you for listening so long. Sorry. I get carried away.
Wow. I'm stew now.
Wow.
Need some water.
Oh, yes. Well, we have fresh tap water.
Oh, that's good. Fresh
tap water.
Sure,
that's a new concept. Excellent. I think we should sell this.
Fresh tap water.
Fresh
this
tap
water.
Yeah.
Straight from the desert.
Fresh tap water, straight from the desert. Excellent. Bullshitter, a guy of some 90 years ago, who I guess he made a name for himself by putting the word excellence, in search of excellence.
In search of
excellence. But that was the thing. That's amazing. I mean, that was an amazing slogan.
Oh,
from that day on, right? Excellence, this institutional excellence.
Oh, now university stuff, you know, it's all best practice.
Best practice, yeah. Exactly. Your core competence.
Your core competence. This entire edifice of just administrative, you know.
Yeah.
Double speak.
Yeah. Double speak is the word.
Yeah. 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 I mean, it's.
That was a deliberate move.
And it's, you know, and nobody. A huge problem. I mean, in the US,
yeah.
and
yeah.
in Europe, maybe, but.
They're getting there. They're getting the disease now. It's been less of a morsel with the European Union thing now.
Yeah. I mean, what's happening in the States? Really intractable problem is the increasing separation and distance of professional academic administrators from the rank and file.
Yes.
So it used to be, the dean, the provost, etc., you know, just
calculated
up to the faculty, so they understood and had an inquiry for, you know,
yes,
what faculty.
No, that was just a division. They had this class over there, the
yeah.
class.
And now, this increasing separation
yes,
is
yes.
actually a huge problem. 7 years till I get fucking dust, and then they go somewhere else and get all the salary and have no organic relationship to the institution. And so it's easy for them to say, well, my job is to make sure that we don't get sued. Sure, I'll hire another vice president who makes us have stupid meetings so we can fulfill our accountability. I mean, and that separation, and the thing is, in the States, nobody knows at different universities. It's like, well, nobody has a good idea about how to fix this. Because it's kind of a political system. The only thing that can fix it are the other administrators who are running the system.
And it serves them just right.
They go from dean
to
provost
to president. And then they move to president to community college. Not going to back down to the faculty or the students or whatever. Staff is always flexible.
Oh, yeah. I've seen things just make it completely fine. And then one go off to a bigger and better job.
Kick upstairs or whatever. But they feel that well, career-wise.
This is the problem. In the U.S. and how this thing's gotten completely out of hand. Because if you have people coming up from the faculty, they would say, hang on a fucking minute, do you have any idea what you're about to do and how that affects faculty quality, how you rose faculty to research and scholarship and teaching, et cetera, et cetera. And they'd put the brakes on this, And they would also say, I think it's bad. And they would also be willing to say, well, you know what, if they sue us, fine, let them sue us. And we'll deal with that when it happens. But now the argument is preempted.
I know.
It's preempted.
Yes. Which is crazy.
I understand.
And I think that also has to do with a lot of the history, economic uncertainty, the anxiety, and they put this over your heads, already quality control, accountability, playing on people's fears, and at that point, lining up, going through the loop, you might have a job. And it's not even me because I'm threatening you, and it's just putting us all in jeopardy. So, get back it up, you know me, and follow it up.
If you want to go to the provost and complain about it, the provost, her job is so completely impossible. It's a 24-hour day job. She's got so much stuff going on. She has other people to deal with this stuff. And those are the John Cornwells, institutional excellence vice president. Those are those people. And in a way, it's like, well, yeah, maybe that's what her job is like. That's what the search committee that hired her. I get it. She's not like she's some asshole or some stupid person. It's the structure.
Sure.
Or systemic.
Incentives and foundations they
can lend